It's called protein degradation. And if you're a bad protein in a cancer cell, you'd better get your affairs in order. Because now, thanks to Dana-Farber's foundational work, protein degradation can target cancer-causing proteins and destroy them, right inside the cell. This take-no-prisoners approach is making a difference in multiple myeloma and other blood cancers, and is how Dana-Farber is working to treat previously untreatable cancers. Learn more at danafarber.org/everywhere.
Good jobs news, yes. Not great, though. Good. Kinda. That and the week that was. Straight ahead from American Public Media. This is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, everybody, the fourth day of September. Good, as always, to have you along. The macroeconomic number of the day as this pandemic gets set to enter its seventh month, if you can believe that, is 1.37 million. That is jobs added to this economy in the month of August. 3 million people who'd been temporarily laid off came back to work, and that helped bring the unemployment rate down almost 2 percentage points to 8.4%. All of that is good, like I said. But a chunk of those jobs, a 250,000 or so, are temporary census workers who are going to be out of work again soon. And more to the point, job growth is slowing. 1 million plus in August, as I said. It was nearly 5 million a month back in June. What else ought you bear in mind? Well, Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman is on the Putting the Jobs Report in Context beat today.
This economy has been through a lot since mid-March. About 15% of all the jobs in America evaporated in just a few weeks. We've been clawing back those jobs ever since. Here's how Brad McMillan at Commonwealth Financial Network rates the latest report.
It was good. It wasn't great, but it was certainly solid. It says we're continuing to make progress, but we also have a long way to go.
Gaining 1.4 million jobs would be blockbuster in normal times, but economist Beth Akers at the Manhattan Institute says now that number
may be giving the misimpressions that we're doing pretty well digging out of this hole, but the reality is that we're only about halfway out.
A little over 10 million of the 22 million jobs we've lost have come back, and job gains are slowing. Akers says this is really a tale of two recoveries.
Employment levels for higher income workers have almost come back to pre-crisis levels, whereas employment levels for low-wage workers remain significantly below where they were. And it's also unclear when those workers will be able to get back to work.
Jobs in bars and restaurants, for instance, are still down 25% from before the pandemic, which leaves a lot of workers out of the recovery so far. Like Cody Sorensen. He's 33, worked as a server at an upscale Italian restaurant in West Hollywood until mid-March. Sorensen's on indefinite layoff. He's still getting health benefits and a $400 a week unemployment check. When that runs out,
I mean, I'm just going to have to go and find like another job, or I'm just going to have to move, I guess, back home to Texas, you know,
where he hopes there'll be less competition for any new jobs that come up. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
All right, with that as backdrop, let's dig in a little bit on jobs and the other news of the day and this week. Gina Smilek is with the New York Times. Kate Davidson is at the Wall Street Journal. Hey, you two.
Hey, Kai.
Hey, Kai.
So, Kate, let me start with you, picking up on Mitchell's spot. And he gave a nod to this, but I want to make sure people get it. There is, despite this good, not great report today, there is some underlying fragility in this economy, right? 29 million people on some kind of unemployment benefit, small businesses closing left and right, yeah?
That's right. As you sort of hinted at, Kai, it was kind of a mixed report. You know, on the one hand, 8.4% unemployment is much lower than where many people thought we'd be at this point. But things are still really bad. And I guess the thing to understand is that the people who are still out of work, many of them are people at the lower end of the wage scale that have mm-hmm. jobs in industries that have been harder hit by the pandemic. You know, hotel workers, restaurant workers, people in industries that are still struggling to come back. And the longer these people stay out of work, the risk is that those more and more of those job losses become permanent. So it's on the right track, but, you know, a long way to go still.
Yeah. Those permanent job losses, that longstanding damage to the economy, Gina, is something Fed Chair Powell talks about a lot. He gave an interview to Morning Edition this morning. It's going to air, I think, on Monday. The transcript is out for those who want to dig in. I want to parse a couple of things he said. Number one, low interest rates in this economy are going to be here, and this is quoting Powell, for a period measured in years. That is, I mean, it's kind of, we know it, but it's kind of amazing.
Yeah. Yeah. No surprise to bond markets, which are, you know, obviously recognizing that we're in for a really long period of low interest rates. But I think that, yeah, it's remarkable if you remember back to the 2007 to 2009 recession and, you know, sort of within not a very long time span, people mm-hmm. were talking about, you know, when is liftoff? When is the Fed going to raise rates? You know, when do they start removing this extraordinary accommodation? And I feel like, you know, over the last decade, that conversation has just fundamentally shifted. And a lot of that owes to Jerome Powell, who has been very clear about communicating that we're in this for the duration. You know, they are not planning on just like immediately raising rates as soon as we get past sort of the worst of this recession. We are in this environment for a really long time until the job market has, you know, healed. And then really after what the Fed has signaled quite clearly is until inflation picks up.
Yeah. Which goes back to what he was talking about last week in pseudo Jackson Hole, as it were. Kate, one of the other things that Powell talked about with Morning Edition today is debt and fiscal policy. And specifically, he said, you know what? We need help now in fiscal policy. This is not the time to worry about debt and fixing that structure, which goes to a piece you wrote this week about the size of the federal debt and how it's going to be this coming fiscal year as big as the entire economy.
That's right. We've seen since March, given all the spending to fight the pandemic and tax revenues going down because people out of work, the debt to GDP ratio, that is, you know, the level of debt that we have compared to the size of the economy, is almost at 100%. And at the end of last year, for just some point of reference, it was just about 80%. That's a huge jump. Doesn't mean anything, though. I think if we listen to what Chair Powell was saying, and like Gina said, we look at bond markets, they're kind of saying not really. Interest rates are so low, and that means that the government can borrow for very, very little money, for lack of a better term. You know, the costs of that debt are going down, and the Congressional Budget Office put out a report this week saying that despite this, serious, significant deterioration in the economic outlook, despite all this extra spending, they actually see us spending less over the next 10 years on interest costs than they did in March before the pandemic, which is just really remarkable. And that suggests that we still have a lot of room to borrow. And so you have, you know, legislators and a lot of economists, frankly, saying there's no reason not to do this. We can afford this. We should be spending more to support the economy right now. And even if it adds to the debt, it's well worth it.
Yeah, but look, Gina, I super don't want to get political on this because it's really fraught. But you can see, and we have seen in the past number of months, the idea of, oh my goodness, federal debt, we have to cut, becoming a factor in this election, right?
I think certainly you do see that. I think certainly you hear a little bit about it from Senate Republicans in particular. Yeah. I think it was notable that you didn't hear anything about it at the RNC, at the Republican National Convention last week. Basically no mention of the debt or the deficit, which makes sense because it's run up dramatically under President Trump's leadership. I imagine that will change after the election, depending on who's mm-hmm. in office. Mm-hmm. But I do think it is a really interesting question to watch sort of how the politics of debt change. As Kate mentioned, you know, we clearly leave some of these historical limitations on what it means to run a big national debt in the past, along with higher interest rates.
Kate, how do you stop people like just who read the Wall Street Journal or New York Times and freak out about the fact that the debt is so big? It is a scary number, and people sort of look at it and go, oh, my goodness, we have to stop.
It's so hard, Kai. I'm
down a little debt rabbit hole here. Sorry.
No, I get so many reader emails, and I try to respond to a lot of them. And yeah, it's just kind of walking them through that idea. I think one of the most important charts were what we were talking about before, the interest costs. And also, I think when you listen to economists try to explain this, it's also kind of getting at the idea that a household balance sheet is very different than the government's balance sheet, right? You know, the government isn't going to die when they get to a certain age. Mm-hmm. You know, the government has never defaulted on its debts. It's just a very different dynamic, and it's very hard for people to understand. You know, they have to live within their means, and why can't the government? But the reality is, they're really two very different things. It's not really an apt comparison. And so I try to explain to people, you know, if you could buy something and basically pay an almost zero interest on it, and it would better your life, it would improve your life, your quality of life, would that make sense? On the other hand, the worry is, of course, that we'll get to some point, maybe it's years away, like Jerome Powell said, but at some point rates could go up. And when you have a debt that's so large, it becomes much more sensitive. Those little changes in interest can cost a lot of money. So there's still some concern there, and it's important to talk about.
Which we're trying to do calmly.
But it's
Kate
not
Davidson
an urgent problem.
The Wall Street Journal. Not right now. Right, exactly.
Right, exactly.
Kate Davidson, Wall Street Journal. Gina Smilek at the New York Times on a Friday afternoon. Thanks, you two. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Kai.
Have a nice weekend. On Wall Street on this Friday in early September. Well, look, at least it's not going to be the Wawa's, right? We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Speaking of interest rates, as we just were, if you're a homeowner, you've probably at least thought lately about refinancing your mortgage. For 6 weeks in a row now, the average rate on a 30-year fixed-rate mortgage has been below 3%. There are, according to the mortgage data company Black Knight, nearly 18 million people who could have taken at least 0.75 percentage point off their interest rate if they'd refinanced. So why aren't more of them doing it? Marketplace's Amy Scott has that one.
Jesse Ziegler has been thinking about refinancing for a long time. When he and his wife bought their house in Atlanta 5 years ago, their mortgage had a 4.75% interest rate. Since then, they've seen rates rise and fall and fall.
And then finally, we were able to refinance down to 3%.
Which, when the paperwork goes through, will save them up to $400 a month. A lifeline, given that Ziegler's hours have been cut at his job in flight operations for Delta.
Yeah, I mean, I wish we would have done it earlier.
But by waiting, as rates kept falling, he's saving more money. Ziegler was able to fold the closing costs into the loan and will break even pretty quickly. Not something everyone can do. Greg McBride, chief financial analyst with Bankrate, says that's one reason people don't refinance.
Even though the cumulative savings over the years to come by refinancing is tens of thousands of dollars, to somebody that's short on cash, that can be a tough sell.
And there's just the hassle, the shopping around for rates and scanning documents and getting an appraisal. Tim Egerton, a creative director in San Diego, remembers thinking about refinancing last summer when interest rates fell sharply.
With all that we had going on in our life, just feeling like another thing to do and more paperwork, and we weren't uniquely hard up for the money.
But that's changed. Egerton's wife is a hairdresser, and her salon has been closed for much of the past several months. They were told they couldn't refinance until she's working again and can verify her income. She started back this week, and they plan to give it another shot. I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Coming up,
we can still make children laugh even, you know, through an iPhone.
Some good news for a change. But first, yeah, sure, let's do the numbers. The Dow Industrial is down 159 points today, 0.5%, 28,133. The NASDAQ off 144 points, that's 1.2%, 11,313. The S&P 500 ended the day 28 points lower, 0.8%. Finished at 34.26. Let me tell you, though, that was a climb back from an ugly morning. For the week, the Dow off 1.8%. The NASDAQ gave back 3.25%. S&P 500 down 2.3%. The holiday weekend is upon us, as you know, and in the pre-COVID era, that meant people getting on planes and flying to all sorts of places. Now, not. TSA says the number of people it processed yesterday was just above 877,000 people. That is almost a 60% drop from the same time a year ago. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdal. We have been reporting low these many months, how the virus has changed and is changing what and how we buy. Today, soup. The Campbell's Soup Company reported a 17% jump in sales after the pandemic started. This week, a 12% jump for the most recent quarter. Really nice numbers, honestly, for a company that had been honestly struggling for years. But as they say, past performance is no guarantee of future results. Marketplace's Justin Ho is on that one.
Campbell's has a slew of familiar brands in its portfolio. Kettle potato chips, Goldfish crackers, V8 tomato juice. And the company says one of the biggest sellers of the past year, that quintessential comfort food, plain old soup. John Stanton is a professor of food marketing at St. Joseph's University. He's got some Campbell's tomato soup in his pantry right now.
I just can't make from scratch good tomato soup. So it's like the only one I buy.
Stanton used to consult with Campbell's and says soup is a high-margin product for the company, so the pandemic has spurred a nice revenue bump.
I think that they should enjoy it because I don't think it's going to last forever.
Campbell says it expects soup sales to decline, given how explosive this year's growth has been. Phil Limpert at Supermarket Guru is a food industry analyst. He says canned foods like Campbell's flew off the shelves because people were hoarding grocery staples and buying whatever was still available.
It was the only thing on the shelf. So people bought it, and people's cupboards, even to this point, are still stocked.
But even if soup sales decline, all that hoarding could boost the Campbell brand overall. Prasad Vana at Dartmouth University says all those soup cans and snacks people crammed into their cupboards,
they are really big banner ads right inside people's homes.
Soup has buoyed the brand this year, but Campbell says it'll invest more in products we like to eat in good times and bad. That includes cookies, potato chips, and packaged broth. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
We were talking earlier in the program about jobs, as you remember, and this morning's good but not great report from the Labor Department. But look, they got their ways of looking at the American labor force. We got ours. One of ours is a series we started earlier this year called The United States of Work. 10 people we found who were a basically representative sample of the labor force as a whole and who we asked how this economy is working for them. Kate Bellino is one of the 10. When we first introduced you to her back in February, she was a new account rep at First Bank Colorado. But September, it turns out, is going to be a big month for her, so we got her back on the phone. Kate, it's good to have you back on.
Thank you so much for having me, Kai.
So what is going on at First Bank Colorado since last we spoke, which was a number of months ago? What's the latest?
First Bank is still plugging away. It's, I am solely focused on the Paycheck Protection Program still. Last time we spoke, I had been moved over temporary to the contact center. Mm-hmm. I've actually been promoted to a manager, so now I am managing the contact center. So lots of changes since we've last talked, definitely.
You are also finishing up school soon, right? Or have you just...
I am finishing up school this weekend. My last class ends on Sunday. I'm so excited.
Good for you. Good for you. Now, here's the question that all college graduates get asked. What are you going to do with yourself now?
What do you want to do when you're done with school? Last time we talked, I was finishing up my business management degree with the plan of applying for First Bank's management trainee program. Mm-hmm. Before the pandemic, that was definitely the goal, and I have some news. I'm actually relocating to Washington, D.C. at the end of the month, and I am pursuing some opportunities in public service.
So, well, number one, wow. Number two, do you have a job lined up yet, or are you just up and moving? What are you doing? And more importantly, why?
Yeah, so, 2020 has been a year, as I'm sure the entire country is experiencing and kind of going through. I've really kind of shifted in who I am and who I want to be and how I want to kind of use my voice in whatever capacity I'm in, whether that's the private sector, public sector, helping people with finances or helping human rights initiatives. I just feel very called to work in a public service capacity. So right now I don't have a job lined up. My partner and I are kind of up and moving. Once I get to DC, I am hoping to start networking, sending out resumes kind of everywhere and just kind of seeing which opportunities present themselves once I'm physically there.
I think we have to dig into this a little bit, right? Because people will not be able to hear this on the radio, but you are Chinese American. You were adopted as a toddler from China into a white family. And I imagine the events of this summer and this spring have sort of landed on you a little bit.
Yes. So personally, I've been kind of going through a self-reflecting kind of soul-searching journey. Growing up as an adopted Chinese American in a predominantly white community, I was afforded the, I guess, privilege of not having to really pay attention to what was happening with my community, the Chinese American community in the United States. And I definitely lived a very privileged life in that sense where I just kind of turned a blind eye to it. But with the events of this summer, I recognize that that's not okay and that I am better and that I can do better. And that is kind of where this journey has taken me. I would really love to get involved in social justice, human rights, civil rights initiatives out in DC. It's definitely been a very interesting turn of events and turn of direction in my life, but I feel 100% ready for this, and I definitely think that it's where I'm supposed to be and what I'm supposed to be doing.
Well, good luck to you, Kate. Kate Bellino, we got her in Colorado at First Bank out there for a while and then going to D.C. to see what she can do. Kate, thanks a lot. I appreciate your time.
Thank you so much for having me. It was so great talking to you again.
Nice to talk to you, Kate. We'll talk to you soon. Laughter might not be able to cure all of the increased stresses and anxieties a lot of us and a lot of our kids are feeling from this pandemic, but it's important. Laughter is, I think. And, well, if you're not going to take it from me, here's a professional.
My name is Susie Estes. I live in New York City, and I am a children's entertainer with my husband, and we perform as Sammy and Tootie. So we did a lot of online parties in April, May, June, and then it started sort of weaning out. We've only done like maybe one or two parties a week. It's definitely not like a regular schedule for us. We've done a few things where we'll make a 30 to 40 minute video, and then people can have access to it for a week. And that's something that, you know, a few libraries and summer camps have done. And I think that might be something that we can continue to do maybe with schools. You know, the Zoom parties pay about, you know, a third to, you know, a quarter of what we normally would make going out and doing a live event. So financially, it's difficult. You know, we've thought about moving because we've started thinking about, well, golly, if we can't make New York City money, can we live in New York City? Humor is humor. So kids find, you know, the same jokes funny, and the same sort of style of what we do does seem to resonate, which is comforting to know that we can still make children laugh even, you know, through an iPhone. That's been probably the best part of this, is being able to expose ourselves to all over the country. And even, you know, Canadians, I think we've had a few, and we had one child who was in Hong Kong, and it seems rather frivolous, you know, sometimes. But, you know, one of the things I've been thinking about is how when you laugh, you're in the moment. You can't think about yesterday. You can't think about tomorrow. You're just really present. And I think that's one of the reasons why laughter heals and makes people feel better, is because you can't grab on to the unknown.
Makes sense, right? That was Susie Estes in New York City making people laugh. Tell us about your economy, would you? Online at marketplace.org. This final note on the way out today, it's kind of a glass half full, glass half empty kind of thing. GasBuddy.com says gas prices this Labor Day weekend are the lowest they've been since 2004. $2.19 is the average price per gallon. That's down 37 cents from a year ago. So yay. But where are you going to go? Okay, we are done and out of here on a Friday, but here is a moment of economic context to send you into the long weekend. Gets us back to the jobs report with which we began today. And yes, the overall unemployment rate is down to 8.4%. Good, not great, but good. But for white Americans, it's 7.3% unemployment. Black Americans, 13%. I mention that because if we stop paying attention to this, we're going to stop paying attention to this. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Nancy Cassett is the managing director of news. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you Monday, everybody. Enjoy your long weekend if you get one. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.